Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 140 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling, and now, a word from Jim Fitzgerald, Far West agribusiness and agricultural advocate. It is rare that you find an individual with Jim Fitzgerald's background in the bully pulpit. Without a doubt, most farmers and ranchers who hear this podcast will cheer his message heartily. That's why it's wise for everyone to listen to it. I've known Fitzgerald for nearly 20 years. Not well, always in a business context. He was, to me, an unknown farmer-rancher from Asotin County when he was appointed executive director of the State Farm Service Agency in Spokane in 2001. In my capacity as a reporter for the Capital Press back then, I interviewed him upon his appointment and several times subsequently. I was surprised when several years later he was named Chief of Staff of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Rural Development Agency, overseeing the day-to-day operations of a 7,000-strong workforce. When that stint ended in 2008, he returned to Eastern Washington to become the executive director of the Far West Agribusiness Association. Speaking of which, you'll hear me misspeak the organization's name in our conversation ahead when I refer to it inaccurately by the title that was stuck in my head from my reporting days and which changed more than a decade ago. I had no intention of producing a two-parter from my conversation with Fitzgerald, but plans change in production. I've told you before about the idea of killing babies, that is, the deletion of parts of an interview which I have resolved to save, only in the end having to sacrifice. In the case of Fitzgerald's conversation, there were just too many babies. Hence, part two of our conversation, which you can hear next Tuesday. Before I get to our conversation, I wanted to ask you, my listeners, a favor. Every week, I post on the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page a description of that week's episode and a link to the show, along with photos of guests, tours I've taken, even PowerPoint slides. Please like the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. It's another great way to stay up to date with each podcast episode that's released. For those who haven't subscribed to Wheat All About It through a podcast app, liking the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page serves a similar purpose in helping listeners stay up to date on each exciting, informative, and entertaining episode. Do your host a solid and like the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. Now, on to the show. Before Fitzgerald took the job at the state FSA, he was both a rancher and a farmer, one of the few left, because in the early 1970s, a Secretary of Agriculture named Earl Butts advised farmers to plant fence row to fence row. That meant tearing out fences. As part of the process, many wheat farmers sold the cattle they had traditionally raised. I've always been intrigued by those who have hung on to both cultures, like Fitzgerald, so I began our conversation in the Far West Agribusiness Association office west of Spokane on July 19, 2019, with a question that was really just intended to satisfy my curiosity. Back when he was in the trenches, how did he think of himself? As a wheat farmer or a cattle rancher?
Good question. I'm probably a has-been, because I'm neither, but I have always farmed and I've always had cattle, at least up until 2014 and 15, we started to sell the cattle and haven't had those since. So in our part of the country, it's a lot of ridges and canyons, and so it just lends itself to do both.
But when you identified yourself back in the day, did you say, I'm Jim Fitzgerald, I'm a rancher?
I've been called a lot of things, including a rancher and a farmer, but I guess if you looked at income, there was more income coming from the farm side. So, but I've been involved in commodity organizations for both, so I think probably identified more as a farmer. I heard years ago that the difference between a farmer and a rancher is that they both have a dog, but the farmer leaves his dog at home during the day.
Okay. So you were state FSA director for several years, and then you went back to the other Washington to be chief of staff for the Rural Development Association, I think. Now, when did you realize you liked being in an office as much as being out on the range?
Well, I'll tell you, the first time when I made that transition was probably during a snowstorm when I could look outside and I was in the warmth of an office and see the storm taking place and I wasn't in it. So I knew that there was definitely advantages to being in an office.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so what do you get out of office life that you don't get out of working on a ranch or a farm?
Well, when you're on the farm and on the ranch, you most of the time work alone or periodically with other people. When you work in an office, you work with a lot of people. I like people, I like business, I like agriculture. So the people part is definitely rewarding. You can learn from other people, you can partner, you can team up. So that aspect is something that you don't get, so to speak, on the range.
Yes, absolutely. So what about your wife? I mean, she met you and married you as one man, and then you have become another, haven't you?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm still the same person. I don't think the job is the person. So yes, the jobs have changed, the responsibilities have changed, but we've been together 40 years. I'm still able to make her laugh, keep her entertained, and make her wonder kind of what's next. So I think both of us don't like to be bored. I'm very fortunate that she grew up in an Air Force family, so she's used to moving. In fact, when we first went to the farm, after a couple of years, it was like, so what's next? And so that's helped, I think, a lot over the years.
Absolutely. You're now executive director of the Far West Fertilizer and Agrochemical Association. And for those in our audience who may not be familiar with the organization, please describe its function, membership, and funding process.
Sure. So it's a trade organization. It's 60 years old. It's had several mergers throughout that 60 years and had some name changes. So it has been, for the last 15, 18 years, Far West Agribusiness Association. So that's how we identify with ourselves. It is a regional trade association. It covers five states: Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Utah, and Nevada. We have about 122, I believe, the most recent count, businesses that are members. Most of them are ag retailers. Some are manufacturers, wholesalers, some independent agronomists. But our members are people that provide either crop inputs or services to farmers. And what we do for our members is we represent them and their interest in the various state legislatures. So we have three full-time lobbyists that work for Far West in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. And I have the pleasure to work with them. They're very sharp and gifted individuals. We also work with a number of agencies that regulate us. So all the regulatory issues, whether they're existing or if there's a new law and new regulations are being written, we try to work with that agency to make them work for industry, our members. And third and final area is training and continuing education. So there's some specific training that, such as ag spill response, safe handling of ammonia, that you just can't get at a community college. So we've developed the curriculum. We hire the person from within the industry to teach those classes and hold those periodically throughout the year. About 80% of our revenue comes from members, and about 20% roughly comes from administering programs like the Certified Crop Advisory Program. That's a national program. We We administer the Northwest regional portion, which is our five states plus Alaska and British Columbia. And then we put on seminars and training and whatnot. So that generates some revenue for it.
The 2017 Census of Agriculture came out recently, and as I recall, Washington has lost about 2,000 wheat farmers since 1997, while very little acreage has been taken out of production. What's happened to the membership of Far West during that same period in terms of, you know, we're looking at the consolidation on the ground. Does that expand out to you, consolidation, here in your Far West Association?
Where consolidation has affected us most is in the major manufacturers, the chemical companies. So when you have Bayer absorb Monsanto, you have Dow and DuPont get together, and then Corteva, all those affect us in a number of ways, but probably the most monetary way would be in membership. So sometimes, because our membership, industry membership, is based on how much revenue that company generated last year in our geographic area, sometimes the merger results in a bump into a different category, which means more revenue to support the organization, and sometimes it doesn't affect it at all, and in that case, we've lost a membership. So, you know, it's just hard to know, but the mergers of manufacturers, I think, is just a derivative of the market.
I was surprised by what you just said in terms of that you have grown your membership. I would have thought that you have lost membership. How have you grown your membership?
You know, if you're able to provide a service or do, it's like any other niche market, do what others cannot do, you have value, and they want to be a part of that. They also take a look at who is a member, and sometimes if they're vendors that sell into that market, they want to be a part of the organization so that they can be included in the directory, they can be found, they can provide the services. So an example that comes to mind is kind of what's referred to as the land planes, the large sprayers. And most of our members don't own those, but they'll lease those and do custom applications. And so obviously, all of those manufacturers are interested in getting in front of the representatives that write the checks and persuade them to have a lease with them. Mm-hmm. It's good for the farmers, too, because the farmers, obviously, they'd like to own that. Not all of them can afford a new one, but maybe after it gets 1,000 hours on it, they'll be able to buy it in the used market, and mm-hmm. it's been well-maintained and taken care of. So it works all the way around pretty well.
I've never heard that phrase used before, land planes.
Yeah. Well, they go almost as fast as a plane compared to the old ones. You're right.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. You recently had a success with the advocacy part of your mission when the Washington State Department of Ecology removed ammonium sulfate from a list of toxic air pollutants known as the TAP list. Before we get to the list, what is ammonium sulfate, how is it used, and for how long?
Oh, I hope you don't want the chemistry breaking down, because that's been a while. But ammonium sulfate, it's an inorganic chemical. It is 21% nitrogen, 24% sulfur. So it's pretty sulfur rich. There are crops that really respond to sulfur. Barley is one of them. Potatoes absolutely love sulfur. It's in a sugar granular type form, so it's not a powder. It's pretty easy to handle. It can also be in a liquid form. Most of the ammonium sulfate in the state of Washington, believe it or not, is used in conjunction with Roundup, glyphosate. When it takes the place of the surfactant, it enhances the uptake of the chemical, and a lot of times farmers will use less glyphosate per acre because of this, and it also has a little residual fertilizer to it. Mm-hmm. So it sort of tricks the plant into saying, "Ooh, I like this. I'm gonna grow," and then it just pulls it in. So that's the it can be, because it's in a granular, Most often it can be easily mixed into specialty formulations for nutrient management. So it can end up in blueberries or vegetables or shrubbery, nursery. There's just a whole multitude of things that it can be used for. So it's got an important market place.
Mm-hmm. And then suddenly ecology put it on its toxic list. Why?
Yeah, that's what we said. Why? So we had good familiarity with the product. We thought we did. Reached out to members. But we first checked EPA's HAP list, which is a hazardous air pollutant list, and it wasn't on there. And then we queried some other states and did our research. And the only states at that time that we could find were California and Washington State. We have since learned that Oregon has it, and we're not sure when that was, but I'm scheduled to be in Oregon within the next month to talk about that particular subject. So we reached out to an industry expert on the East Coast and had them educate us as to two areas. One is the air particulate portion. Is it hazardous as a respiratory? Because this California study had to do with it was an aerosol study. So is it a problem to breathe? And then number two, is it toxic? And so once we learned all we could, more than we probably ever thought we would know about ammonium sulfate, that it was derived from the salts of sulfuric acid. Again, you know, just a lot of detailed information. We then reached out to Department of Ecology and the department heads, air quality as well as toxicity, and had a number of exchanges, communication, written as well as phone calls, and ask, you know, finally found out how did it get on there? When did it get on there and how did it get on there? Well, come to find out, the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, the OEHHA. Funny that there's a ha in there, I think. And they commissioned a study, this aerosol study, by a company called UTEL. And they provided the study. And the OEHHA office from California made a mistake. They misinterpreted the data within the study. It wasn't in question. It wasn't debatable. They just made a mistake in reading it, and they added it to their TAP list. When Washington State decided to take a look and repopulate and review what should be on their TAP list, they saw that it was on in California, and evidently nobody checked it or read it or had the same misunderstanding, and they added it. So that starts the challenge of how do you reverse that? Because we didn't think that it belonged on there, on everything that we could get a hold of and everything that we could learn about it.
So in essence, Washington was just following California's lead, and California didn't know what they were doing.
That's right. And the irony, too, again, is this is the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. So their job is to assess what's hazardous, and they made a mistake.
Interesting, interesting.
So their job was to assess, they misassessed.
And so what did you do? How did you change ecology's mind?
So we sort of worked our way up through the department heads and eventually met with the director and the Office of Legislative Liaison, Government Affairs. I believe that was in August of 2016 or 17. We first learned about this from a member in January of 2015. We finally got a hearing on it in December of 2018, and in May of this year, DOE put out their decision-making memo and stated that they were willing to remove it. To answer your question a little more precisely, we couldn't get a solid answer when, through the rules process, that we would have a chance to have a hearing to state our case. And so it was, you know, they just explained, we're busy. There's a lot of other more important things. This only affects, you know, a small part of the state. And I understand that. And but our members are having, when they complete an air quality permit, they have to add certain sections to this. So this section was added. So it adds to the cost, and plus it makes them subject to audit. And our position was, why are we doing this? If it's not toxic, it shouldn't be on the list. DOE offered to do a general order, make it easier to do the permit. Well, we appreciated that, but if we don't need a permit, it doesn't matter how hard or easy it is to get the permit. So we sort of held our ground. And it turned out we had to hire an attorney here in Spokane and have them help us, guide us through the petition process. So we formally filed a petition to DOE to hold a hearing and go through the rules process. And if they would have denied that, it would have been a judicial or a legal alternative, but good for them. They didn't do that. Nobody wants to do that. So eventually we got this hearing December 10th of 2018, and we worked with some really good people at Department of Ecology. They weren't upset with us because we petitioned. They understood it was simply business, and we got it removed.
And that must have felt really good that you got it removed, but it came with a cost, didn't it?
It came with a cost. It's not anything we had budgeted for. So the association is a nonprofit, spent about $10,000 on legal fees and you know, hiring an expert to educate us. One of our members spent over $6,000 and paid to have a study review done of the UTEL study that was done in California, and they were able to then go beyond that and look everywhere in the country to see if anywhere there was any report of ammonium sulfate being a health hazard, either respiratory or toxicity. And finding none provided this about a 20-page report, and that helped a lot, because then Ecology could put their experts on it, you know, work through it. And I think that was a big part of it. We had another member that had expertise in air quality and OSHA requirements, because OSHA has certain thresholds, ASILs. We've learned a lot about things. And there was the loading and unloading of this. If it was a powder, it'd be different. But because it was granular, there was little or no dust. And so Ecology actually did, I think I have this right, three different tours over 2 years to fertilizer facilities, different parts of the state that handled ammonium sulfate. And they had a toxicologist and an air quality person with them. I was able to go on the third tour. And each one of those tours had two or three visits. So, you know, sites during the tour. So I will say, they did a very extensive job. To me personally, it seemed like, wow, a lot of effort looking for a problem. Mm-hmm. And so no one can ever be critical that they didn't give it the full attention that it deserved.
Is there a take-home message from this?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is, you know, do your homework. You know, before you ever start down this road, you've got to be confident that you understand the issue and can successfully argue it, because there will be a debate, and there will be ample opportunities to get off course. So know your stuff, do your homework, hold your ground, probably would be important. Again, all the distractions and compromises and whatnot. And you'll be made to feel that you are wrong, and so that's never easy. And then probably the most important is keep the emotion out. You know, just stay focused. Respond in a responsible way. You know, don't let personalities get involved. Mm-hmm. It's just business. You know, it is what it is. If it looks like a cow, it's probably a cow. You know, call it a cow, that type of thing. So,
but emotion is getting to be so important in all of these issues. You're telling us to keep emotion out of it, and yet it seems like everything is emotion.
That's right. That's right. But when it comes to science, if that's what you're relying on, then it should speak for itself, and you shouldn't have to be emotional. So we could have, I mean, this all occurred during a governor's race. You know, it was not business friendly. We could have made it a political issue. We could have put it on social media. We chose not to. We chose to work just shoulder to shoulder with the agency. And again, we were able to work with some really good people. And they treated us very fairly. And yes, it took almost 4 years. You know, that really tries the patience of an Irishman. But, but I'm getting better at it.
And $10,000.
$10,000, right.
Listening to Fitzgerald describe what was needed to bring forth a successful conclusion to the ammonium sulfate challenge should be required listening for all those who advocate for agriculture or are in leadership positions in the Pacific Northwest. Far West Agribusiness is lucky to have a person who hasn't just looked at the map, but has actually navigated the bureaucratic landscape before. In fact, all of agriculture is lucky. Not just anybody can straddle the world of farming and the world of bureaucracy. Each requires specialized skills, and to find them in one individual makes Fitzgerald a great advocate. Which is why I called episode 140. And now, a word from Jim Fitzgerald, Far West Agribusiness and Agricultural Advocate. Please join me here again next week for the second part of our conversation. And remember to like the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page to receive weekly updates and photos from each episode. Tune in next week for the continuation of my conversation with Fitzgerald as he minces no words about where he stands on questions of importance to agriculture, right here on Weed All About It!
Grass is fine if you've got a cut or 4 feet and stand in the mud, but we've got two and teeth to chew. Don't give us none of that vegetarian stew. We're carnivores and we ain't ashamed. The reason's simple, it's in the refrain. We feed you.